Welcome to Parenting Teens with Dr. Cam, the podcast dedicated to helping you tackle the challenges of parenting teenagers without the drama. I'm your host, Dr. Cam. Let's get on with the show. Today, we're embarking on a transformative journey with a true expert in the field of mental health and resilience, Dr. Carolyn Leaf. Dr. Leaf is not only a communication pathologist, audiologist, and clinical neuroscientist, but also a pioneer in the study of the mind-brain connection. With her extensive background in psychoneurobiology and metacognitive neuropsychology, Dr. Leaf has dedicated her career to understanding how our thoughts and emotions shape our brains. As a host of the podcast Cleaning Up Your Mental Mess and the author of 18 best-selling books, including Cleaning Up Your Mental Mess and How to Help Your Child Clean Up Their Mental Mess, Dr. Leaf is a leading voice in the field of mental wellness. Join us as we learn from Dr. Leaf's wealth of knowledge and experience, gaining insights into how we can raise emotionally resilient teens in today's challenging world. Dr. Leaf, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Dr. Cam. It's lovely to meet you and lovely to be with you today.
You too. So tell us, first of all, how did you get into neuroscience and neurobiology and just understanding the connection between the mind and the brain?
Well, that journey began probably when I was a young child. I was very interested in the mind and the brain. I was going to become a neurosurgeon. I got into medical school, and I decided that that's not really my road to go because I didn't want to just be doing surgery. I wanted to actually interact and understand more on a more theoretical, philosophical level. And so I moved over to a degree that they were offering at the time back in the 80s, which combined medicine and the sort of early days of neuroscience and neurology and psychology and communication pathology, and was very based within hospitals and research-based. And so that really got me into this field. And I mean, there was only 60 of us that qualified in the world, and then they stopped the degree because it was wiping everyone out. And I only say that to say that I nearly left, and thank goodness I didn't, because that training opened my mind to seeing the mind-brain-body connection in a totally different way. And it launched the research I do and the work I do and the millions we now reach. And so I'm very grateful for that. So that's kind of the background to why I am doing what I do.
So explain to us a little bit about what you mean by the mind-brain connection. What is the difference?
Okay, so for thousands of years, there was a very clear understanding of the fact that we had a physical body and that there was something more sort of spiritual that kind of interacted with the body. And that was actually pretty accurate. It was very accurate. Then we had the whole sort of Descartes split where it was mind is separate from brain and they don't really interact, and there's, you know, very clear splits and all these debates. And in the last 40 years, they kind of put that aside, not everyone, but a large body of science put that mind stuff aside and focused on the brain. And I saw this in the 40 years of the work I've been in the field, because it was from the mid-90s that they discovered the MRI. The technology was discovered in 44, but it was only by 96 that they actually got the MRI technology. So we started seeing in the brain. So long story short, the world of neuroscience, neurology, and that world moved very much in the direction of neuroscience and brain. And it was great because we started understanding more about neurobiology and your neuroscience is the study of how that works and the neurons and the impact and so on. But then we kind of put the mind aside. And so the philosophical debate of what is mind and it's the unknown variable and all that kind of stuff was sort of, well, we can't measure it, which is actually inaccurate because we can, but you can't touch it, feel it, see it as easily as the brain. And the brain was just, it's fascinating. I mean, the brain's fascinating. So we became a very neuro-reductionistic society. And that has impacted how we look at ourselves as humans, how we look at mental health, how we look at our adolescents growing up, our children growing up. And the impact is obviously there's always good, but there's also bad. And the bad side is it has had a massive impact on mental health. So I practiced for 25 years and I've been doing research for 38 now, and I don't practice anymore because I decided I'm going to have more impact taking what I'm doing in my research and my clinical practice and putting that into accessible tools. We have a mental health technology platform, web and iOS and Android, which we're constantly developing and growing, where we are trying to empower an individual as well as teams of people, but people, every single human needs to know how to understand the mind-brain-body connection. So that's what we're doing with the work. So that's kind of a long foundation to what is the mind, what is the brain. So the mind is, the easiest way to understand the mind is to think of waves of the sea. Mm-hmm. And then to think of waves of the sea, that sort of energy that propels them. So they're not just stagnant, they're moving. And as they move and change a frequency, and then they hit the beach and they change the shape of the beach. So the mind is this energy force that is creating this movement of stuff. In the case of the wave example, it's the particles. In the case of the mind brain, the mind is this wave of energy that is capturing our experiences, the stuff, the water in the waves, and it puts it into the brain and the body. And that's really important, Dr. Kam, is to recognize that the brain and body operate as a unit, mm-hmm. and the mind is driving the two. So the brain and body without the mind are just basically flesh, they disintegrate. But with the mind as an energy force, gravitational fields and all the things that you pick up with an EKG and an EEG and ultrasounds, and the fact that the blood flows and the heart pumps and all that is energy requiring that movement of blood and oxygen and so on, that is driven by mind. So mind is an energy force that has a mental component of you being a human and experiencing life and memory and all that, and it has a neurophysiological component, which is making the brain and the body actually work. So the brain and the body embody the mind. The mind is embodied in the brain body wide, which is why when you have a PTSD experience, you feel it in your body. Mm. The famous book, The Body Keeps the Score. You know, this is truth because it stores in the brain and the body. So the brain is the physical, body is the physical, the mind is also physical, but it's a different type of physical. It's
it waves. It pulls us all together. It almost pulls it all together and becomes who we are. So how do we use this information of using the mind to help our kids? And let's talk about, I really wanted to talk with you about resilience, because I think this is a concept that we're constantly saying we want to build our teens' resilience. We want to build up resilience. First of all, how do you even define resilience? And then once we know what that is, what do we do as parents to help build that up?
I'm so glad you asked that question, because as you and I both know, that is such a common word used everywhere. It's on book covers. It's in conversations. It comes out all the time. And so it's something that we instinctively know as humans is important for us. And what we've been told in the last 30, 40 years, which is actually been disproved, is that we have limited supplies of resilience, that we run out of resilience. But that's not actually the truth, because your brain, mind, body, or psychoneurobiology, mind, brain, body connection has unlimited supply of resilience. Our whole neurobiology, our psychoneurobiology, all of it is designed to stand up to the stresses of life. It's all designed to support. And that doesn't mean it's all going to be easy. That's not what I'm saying. I'm just saying that our basic psychoneurobiological foundation is one of resilience. So resilience is, in the most simple terms, is the ability that we have as humans to go through the knocks of life and to be able to get back up again. And it's very, very, very activated by our mindset. So if you think of resilience as I was explaining this to someone the other day and it really worked. So let me use it like this.
Please.
And this is an analogy in a book that I'm actually currently writing at the moment. So you're getting a sneak preview of my next book. Think of a door and a doorway that opens. And that doorway that opens into just infinity. You know, we've seen images of that. We've seen movies with that kind of analogy. You can, you know, just that feeling of this door. Now, that's what resilience is like. When you open it, there's unlimited supply. Resilience. And that resilience is quite spiritual. So it's part of our non-conscious, N-O-N. Non-conscious is a scientific term that we have for this mind thing of ours. And this end is, oops, I just bumped something, sorry. So therefore, there's a door that shuts. Now, what opens and closes or unlocks the door and throws it wide or keeps it closed or only opens at a crack? It is how we use our mind. It's how we manage our mind, how we looking at things in terms of, so mind is all of that stuff, and how we manage our mind is going to show up in how we, in our mindsets, our perceptions, it's going to show up in our behaviors, it's going to show up in our signals, I'm sorry, in our emotions, and it's going to show up in how our body feels. So if we, and that collective emotions and perceptions and all that stuff, if the overarching mindset that comes out of that is one of, I'm fragile, I am the coddled mind, I'm fragile, I am broken, if I've had trauma, that's it. TikTok world. There's a lot of, you know, that going on, sort of self-diagnosis, and not that I think TikTok's fantastic. I think all technology is fantastic when managed, and we've got, it's a way of sharing messaging, but we've got to make sure that we accurately
right messaging.
Exactly. So we are not, and the messaging, the zeitgeist is that this, that it's, is that resilience is limited, mm-hmm. and that if you have any kind of trauma or any kind of anything at any stage of your life that disrupts your functioning, that you basically are reducing your resilience. It's getting less, and that you're broken forever, and that because you're broken forever, you need a label, you need a diagnosis, you potentially need whatever. And this is what our teenagers are growing up
with.
This is what Gen Alpha are growing up with. This is the messaging that the adults in their lives are also sending them. It's what every psychiatric website shares. It's what every MD is talking about, you know, MD websites and this kind of thing. And there's a lot of truth, good in those. I'm not saying everything's bad, but this philosophy, this zeitgeist of if I'm broken, I'm always broken is wrong. Mm. I did some of the earliest work in neuroplasticity. And neuroplasticity is the ability that we have to change our brain and body with our mind. Mm. Our brain and body don't change themselves because they're not self-generating. They're physical, that need to be switched on. So, but our mind changes. So that's the foundation of how we wired in this incredible way, mind and brain and body, and we have this ability to change things. So when we shift our mindset to that, what we do is we see, okay, well, things have happened, but I'm not constantly broken. I can heal. I can't change my story, but I can change what it looks like inside the networks of the psychoneurobiology, mind-body connection. When I shift that mindset, I open that door. Mm-hmm. Maybe initially it's a little crack. Maybe it's a little bit of a bigger crack, but eventually I learn how to open. And when the door closes, I keep knowing how to open it. But if I see myself as broken and I see myself as forever broken and a damaged brain and damaged genes that I have no control over, you basically lock that door to resilience. And that's what worries me about the way our children and adolescents are growing up and what a lot of adults are feeling.
So true. Because I was going to ask, but you've explained it already, why kids today seem so unresilient, right? But it's because from what you're saying, which is a big aha moment for me, is it's because we keep sending them messages that they're broken. And we do this in an attempt to fix them, saying, oh my gosh, you're anxious, you're depressed, and we've got this belief that everything's kind of more serious than it is in a way, right? Everything is like clinical problem. So now everywhere they go, we're pointing out where they're broken, and that's where their resilience breaks down.
Exactly. Okay. That is exactly what happens. So we've got this constant message that is coming through every potential platform. And there is obviously the other side of science, which is a massive side of science that has disproved this philosophy and has shown that biomedical model is not working. But that's not what the 95% of people globally think that they have depression because they have a chemical imbalance, that the depression is not from adverse life experiences, it's from a brokenness inside of them. And that actually doesn't remove stigma. The research shows it increases stigma. Mm. So first of all, incorrect. Secondly, it's disproved. And thirdly, it makes the stigma worse. Fourthly, it creates hopelessness, learned hopelessness. And, we try and attempt to fix that by Judy saying this concept of neurodiversity, which is great because it actually starts saying to us that, we're all different. And there's a study that came out of Yale in 2018, which is one I love to quote, because they said there's no normal brain. There isn't any normal brain. Mm. And we have this drive with the current philosophy that, hey, this is a normal brain and your teenager, your adolescent, your child, you are differing from the normal brain. And that's why you're battling. And that's not the truth, because your brain constantly changes. It's always in a state of flux, and it follows the pattern of what your mind is doing. And you, even if you don't fix something like a substance abuse, which is a behavior that's coming from some sort of trauma or brokenness, even if you don't fix that, it doesn't go away. It just gets more entangled, but it keeps changing. Everything's in flux, and it's either in flux in the wrong or the right direction. So the messaging we need to share with our children, our adolescents, and ourselves and adults is that we can change. It's hard and there's a time frame involved, but we can change. the other side of this coin, which is very powerful on a sort of more psychological side, is that I mentioned the word non-conscious. We are predominantly non-conscious. Non-conscious doesn't mean unconscious. Unconscious is when you're sleeping and when you knocked out from anesthesia or a baseball bat, hopefully, or something, not like that. But our non-conscious is a state of functioning as humans that drives us 24/7. It's brilliant. It's the most brilliant part of how you function. It's where all your memories are stored. It's where your messes are made and where your messes are found. And so it works for you. It stores things. It's a force of nature. It's a force of you that is enabling you to function. And it's your conscious mind only operates when you're awake. And your conscious mind is very reliant on the non-conscious mind. But the non-conscious mind doesn't do the changing. It does the prompting. It's the conscious mind that does the changing, which means we have to consciously and deliberately recognize our patterns and do the changing and work with the non-conscious. So the non-conscious will help us, but our conscious has got to do the changes. We've got to be deliberate and intentional. Now, the other side of that is that we are in a world that we're immersed in a world of that's very easy to be immersed in. Every age has its challenges. Our challenge this current age is that our immersion is vast. It's huge and it's accessible knowledge. So when I say immersion, we're getting access to stuff very fast and very quickly. Mm. We're getting feedback very quickly. We're getting, which is great in one sense because our brain loves that, but if it's not managed, it creates chaos. So 95%, if not more, of what is going on around you in the zeitgeist, the articles you read, the TikToks, the social media, the conversations, the voices being spoken over you, what you're hearing at school, etc., that is going into your psyche, 95%, and you're not even aware. You're only aware of around about 1-5%. So that 95 that's going in is driving you. Because if you're hearing it all the time, whatever's going in consistently is becoming a pattern that drives you. So we're dealing with consciously being aware of focusing on stuff, but most people don't know that 95% is going in non-consciously. Mm. That comes through as signals, and what we need to do is learn to self-regulate and recognize and read the signals and then make the changes. And that's the basic sort of idea of a lot of neuroscience.
And I love this, and I love the whole, you know, rewiring and neuroplasticity, and how do we as parents use this knowledge? And we've already talked about we want to build a resilience. A lot of what we're doing to build a resilience based mm-hmm. off what you just said is actually – making them less resilient because we're trying to fix them, yeah. right, to build them. So what do parents do to help build up our children's resilience or open up that door wide open for them?
Three parts to that answer. It's a great question. It's a great, great question. The first thing is we model it for them because our children and our adolescents will really do what we do. You know, it's easy to say something. It's much more difficult to model it. So that's very, very important. I often get asked this question and they say, what would you, for this current crisis, which has also been mis-explained, but what would I do with this current mental health crisis? And the first thing I'll say is educate the parents. Mm. Educate them on what the truth is about mental health and educate them on how to manage their own mental health with the correct philosophy. Stop making it so scary, because going hand in hand with resilience, which goes to the education we need to give to our parents and ourselves, is that resilience is something that is it's infinite and it can constantly be activated. So we've got to give that message. So it's train the parents first. So when we model our own stuff, when we're going through something and we recognize that there's a natural pattern, for example, to healing from depression, and if you give it its natural cycle and you just support with love, you'll get through most, what the research is, something like 90%+ of people will get through that depression phase, because it's not a disease, it's a warning signal. In a natural cycle, and if you interfere with that cycle, you actually can make things worse. So it's to give parents that kind of knowledge, and then for parents to be able to say, like, if they've had a bad day or they're going through something, not to deny it and pretend you know everything, because you don't, but to show your vulnerability as a human and to say, oh, I'm really battling. Sorry, I snapped at you. I lost my cool. I was more aggressive than I should be. It's not you. It is something that I'm going through. Yes, what you said may have triggered me. So you actually go through a process of openly acknowledging your emotions and behaviors and so on, and reflecting on those and actually being a, and showing them what that is. But you don't stop there. You actually go to a point of resolution. So you say, well, this is, it happened like this because of, I think this is why I'm doing this. I'm going to find out, and this is how I'm going to reconceptualize it, and this is what I'm going to do. So when you model that process, which is a five-step process called the neurocycle, which is based on how my information gets into our mind, brain, body network in the first place. How does life get in us? And then how can we reverse engineer the impact and then actually construct that? And so it's a simple process that you can learn. And as a parent, you learn that and you demonstrate that. Then you teach that to your children. And that's what both this book plus the children's book. Where's my children's book over here? I don't know if you guys can see it over here.
How to help, I think it's child. Behind you too. Yeah.
Yeah, there
perfect.
You go.
Perfect, yeah.
So have a, for young children, we have a coloring book. We even have a toy, which I
love it. I want the coloring book.
The coloring book's great. We create scenarios. We even have a toy, the little
wow.
brain books your mental health journey with you. The coloring book is scenarios that can happen and how for a child that's young to be able to color that in and find the page. And then you've got a blank page where you can interact. In other words, it's to provide that. So that first part is you as a parent learn it, you as a parent get educated, you model. Secondly is you then help your child apply this. And that's why I give you the tools. We have the app as well, the NeuroCycle app, which has, you can learn it for yourself. And we have a parent application. We constantly upgrading that all the time. We even have a NeuroLive feature, Dr. Cam, that we've added, where every week I explain something and answer questions. And in other words, that's how, because people say, okay, that's great. I need the knowledge as a parent. I need to model, but what do I do? So the second part of the answer is, these are, I've got the tools, the NeuroCycle. We can even talk a bit more about what that is. I'm happy to explain it. And then the, what was the third thing? I can't remember what the third thing was. It'll come back in a moment.
But let's talk about the NeuroCycle.
And then we'll
go into that.
it'll pop back in my
yes,
mind.
Yes, it will.
Okay, so the NeuroCycle is based on 38 years of research and was initially developed based on my work on neuroplasticity. In the 80s, we went through a weird phase between the 70s and 80s where they believed that the brain couldn't change. So for years, there was the belief that, and then suddenly there was this period of time where, for about 30 years, that they didn't believe the brain could change, and that changed in the 90s with technology when we saw the brain changing. And so I was told that the brain couldn't change, and I remember challenging one of our professors and saying that, but we change. Our life changes. We're right. never the same. So therefore, the brain that the mind uses, and I remember saying, you've just told us in this neurology lecture, in this neuroscience, combined neuroscience neurology lecture, that the mind changes the brain, but you're telling us the brain can't change. So there's a paradox. And basically, this professor said, you know, women in science back in the 80s, oh, well, facetiously said to me, well, go and do the research, thinking I wouldn't do anything. But I did. I took the challenge, did the research, and showed that if you manage your mind, you can change your brain. And that's where the neuroscience was born out of literally that lecture. It drove me and it still drives me because never again do I want, first of all, sexism, patriarchy, whatever you want to call it, to come into anyone's life. And secondly, that's not truth. Truth is that there's hope in our humanity. There's hope in our ability. And so the NeuroCycle grew out of that. So I work with people with traumatic brain injury initially because this professor also said, he really said, do brain injury because there's no hope. That's pretty much what he said.
Worst case scenario.
That's it. Yeah. So I said, oh, and I didn't quite pick up the sort of undercurrent there. And I actually said, oh, okay. And I went and studied and could hardly find any research on her closing injury at the time. Long story short, I show that that if you help a person with a traumatic brain injury, you can actually help them transform their life. So I work with people that had shortly come out of comas, that were non-functional, and quite extreme changes happened in sort of under 12 months. They would go from the one case was a 16-year-old who had basically sort of lost all functionality and was like functioning at about a second grade level. Within 12 months, caught up with her peer group, went on to get degrees. And I can tell you 1,000 similar stories. Wow. So I soon saw, and then I was in South Africa at the time, working in the pre-transition and post-apartheid era, working in the terrible conditions there in the education system, people that weren't educated, full of trauma. And I started applying these principles, and I very quickly saw that through mind management, I can't come in and feed and fix what our government had done and what any kind of racism does. But what I could do is equip an individual with the ability to deal with that emotional impact and help to rewire, and then also help to, them to learn. Because if you think about it, if you are rewiring your brain, you also need to put knowledge in. We need knowledge. So that then led to the neurocycle. Neurocycle was birthed out of all of that, and it's basically taken a complex process and simplified into five basic steps that are the steps that your mind-brain-body connection goes through. And it's like flying a plane. Your plane's got to be prepared. It's got to take off. It's got to fly, and it's got to land. It's a cycle. It's something you would do daily over a period of time, because as you do the neurocycle, you're rewiring the mind-brain-body connection. So you're forming a new habit. So habits don't form in 21 days. So a lot of the research I've done was to find out how long does it take if I do this process. If I do it once, does it work? And I saw, no, it doesn't. If I do it twice, does it work? If I do it 10 days in a row? So I wanted to find out how often, how long, and the bottom line, and we still do research. We've just done another study. I've published papers. We've got a paper coming out this month, and for this year, we're doing more studies. But basically, it takes around 9 weeks to rewire a network. So in the first 3 weeks of working daily, and I will tell you what the neurocycle is, but in the first 3 weeks of working through the neurocycle daily, you will basically find what those signals, the depression, the anxiety, those things in your body, the perspective, those are just signals. They're not symptoms of a disease. They're signals of an experience. Mm. So in the first 21 days, you'll be able to learn to recognize the signals, dig into those signals, find the thought, which is the experience that they're attached to, and find the source, the root, and reconstruct. You can't pull the thought out. You can't, like a plant, you can't pull it out. It's always there, but you can change what it looks like. So you can heal the roots for that's how it's to all of us. And I've got great images in here to be able to explain, for parents to explain to children. So you basically are healing the roots and so on. And that process takes around 3 weeks. But then you've got this tiny little newly formed thought in your mind as a wave pattern, in your brain as a little tree-like structure, and then in your body cells as hedges. So if you recall at the beginning, and I know this is quite a lot to digest, but if you recall at the beginning, we said that that memory and experiences are a body-wide thing. Right. The body keeps the score that people hear about. We know that people go to yoga to release the energy. We know that exercise helps depression. Well, I'm talking about that, okay? So I'm talking about the fact that every experience we have, that traumatic experience, it was an experience that was taken in by your mind, processed by your mind, and stored in your brain as a tree-like structure, in every cell of your body as a hedge-like structure, like a little hedge, tightly packed hedge, and in your mind as a little wave pattern. So three places, and the wave pattern's kind of keeping the whole thing going. So that's what you're doing with the neurocycle, is you are opening those all up, you're finding them, and you are reorganizing them. So they never go away, but instead of staying like a tsunami wave and a very prickly, toxic-looking tree and a hedge that's all ugly and full of thorns, you actually clean it up. That's basically what you're doing. And that process takes about 15 minutes a day for about 3 weeks. Then it's tiny. If it's going to be useful to you, you're going to be able to apply that in your life, mm-hmm. and you start at 21, you're not going to be able to. It's not enough time, because it's still too small. It has to be made bigger. So the next 42 days, you still do the neurocycle, but for less time, and you then basically are growing it bigger and making it stronger. So I'll walk you through this in the app, in this book, in the children, in the adult book, all of it. So that, you know, to get the combination, that's a good combination. You don't have to, but if people want to know what the resources are. Okay, so in essence, what do you do each day? What is the neurocycle? It's five steps. For the first 21 days, you do it for around 15 minutes a day. First couple of days, you'll take longer as you learn the system. Mm-hmm. And then the second set of 42 days, totaling 63, which is 9 weeks. So 63 days is 9 weeks. You're going to spend about 5 minutes a day, still going through the five steps. So that's a minute per step. So we're not talking about hours of time.
No, not at all.
You know, it may take a little longer initially because you're teaching your kids how to do it and whatever. Adolescents love the app because it's technology.
Yeah.
You know, and there's a lot of support things like decompression activities, and there's all kinds of whatever to do extra. So there's the five steps are we've got to prepare the plane, and we've got to get the plane to take off. So step one is preparing the plane and getting the plane to take off. So that's basically preparing the brain, are things like breathing and meditation and just getting yourself in the right mindset. There's a million different activities, and I provide a lot of examples in my materials and walk you through in the app. Then also part of that, once I've prepared the brain and I've got it to a place of sort of the mind, brain and body chemicals calm down, and we've got the energy of the brain calm down and the heart's not beating too fast and the electromagnetic energy of the heart's calm down. When we're in that state, we are in a state where neuroplasticity can happen in the right direction.
Gotcha.
Because neuroplasticity is always happening, but you can drive it in the right direction. Okay. So that's the gather weird. So then you get yourself calm. Then you focus on gathering awareness of your emotions, which are not diseases. You say a little sentence, what am I feeling? Where do I feel this in my body? So bodily sensation. How is this affecting my behavior? So this is in the moment, not mm-hmm. like in your whole life. It's not general, it's specific to the moment. And then how is this affecting my perspective? So maybe it's depression, gut ache, withdrawing, life sucks.
Right.
And then you're going to, so that's now the plane's taken off. Okay. And now I'm going to, as it's taking off, that preparation and identifying those four signals leads me to, it will pull up a thought, because those signals are attached to the experience, which is a thought, which is made of memories. And so I won't see all of it yet, but I'll see, oh, okay, maybe this is related to whatever. So maybe it's self-esteem. I've got no value. And maybe that comes up and there's a thought, oh, okay, I see there's something there about I'm not good enough, a lot of self-talk. Maybe there's something there from when I was a child or an adolescent or recently at the new school or whatever. So you're starting to see something. So that's pulling up the thought. So it's something to do with self-esteem. Now we've just taken off. Now we start flying. And in flying, we're going to reflect. What, why? The who, the what, the when, the where, the why. Mm. What's getting more information? Then you're going to still fly and you're going to do a mind dump where whatever's been stimulated by what you've just done, you just write that down really quickly onto a piece of paper. Whatever comes up, I have a structure called a metacog. I'm not going to go into it now, but there's a way of organizing information that really makes this very effective. But it's a mind dump. It's not journaling.
Right.
Then you're still flying. You need to now look at what you've written, which is accumulation of the three steps, first three steps, taking off, flying. And now you're going to reconceptualize. What does this mean? This has happened. What do about this? And then you end off with step five, which is then landing the plane with an active reach, which is an action to help you to be able to anchor yourself. So it's accumulation of the work done that you've done that day. It's a full stop. You stop there. You don't carry on, or you exhaust yourself. And every time you want to go back to it, you use your active reach to help anchor you and to help stabilize the new thought that's forming. You're not going to solve it today. You have to do it over 63 days. So you come back to it tomorrow. And so it's a little bit every day accumulates and builds, and that's how habits, new habits form. That's how new thoughts form and form into habits. So that's the basic principle of operating. And there's a lot more to it, but that's the basic principle. Oh yeah, I thought we had run out of time, but we still have a bit of time.
Hey parents, feeling overwhelmed? You don't have to do this alone. Join the Thriving Parent Academy, where community support is everything. Member Tracy said, we all developed at an exponential rate together. And Carrie admitted, I didn't think I needed this, but it's a life game changer. Don't wait. Join us at thrivingparent.org and use promo code THRIVE20 for 20% off your membership. Let's thrive together. So this is almost, from what I'm hearing too, it's almost reteaching you how to process your feelings and your thoughts. It's not just the one thought that we're reprocessing. It's just retraining how we process everything exactly. That comes through, where we're just not, this is reality. It's going, okay, this is what I'm sensing. How do I get to turn that into a more productive thought rather than one that's just tearing me down?
Absolutely. You've totally got it. And you said the word process. Mm-hmm. That's exactly what you're doing. You are driving that as you do those five steps, you are literally taking, pulling up that thought and using your mind energy to go and find that thought and to deconstruct and reconstruct it right down to the root. You can't pull it out, but you can change what it looks like inside of you. So you're doing exactly that. You are you're looking at the self-talk. You're looking at and you're actually going down deep and you're saying, okay, well, this happened. I can't change that person did that to me. I can't find out why. Why did that person bully me? They're going through stuff. I don't need to know why they bullied me. I just need to know that my behaviors are coming from that.
Yeah.
So it's not me, there's a because of. And so I reconceptualize, what can I do going forward? Okay, that bullying, I can release, I can whatever. So that's what you're doing. What is happening a lot, Dr. Cameron, I know you know this, I'm telling you, I feel like I'm preaching to the choir here, so forgive me, for those of you that are listening, is that there's a huge movement, and there has been for a few years now, to get your child to name their feelings, even your adolescent. There's feeling circles, there's all kinds of programs going on in schools. And the research is showing that that's actually causing more problems. If we constantly say, you know, how are you feeling? How are you feeling? Gentle parenting. Now, I'm all for gentle parenting, but I'm not all for constantly asking your child, how are they feeling? Because if you just ask your child how they're feeling, or you just talk about, let's have a feeling circle. How do you feel about this? What you've done is you've just brought up a bunch of stuff and then you leave it there. So that's like taking off in the plane, but you've never been taught as a pilot how to fly a plane. What's going to happen? You're going to crash. Yeah. So if you just do meditation with kids in schools, which is what is happening, I'm glad they're doing meditation, and short studies show that, and I say short studies over short periods of time do show changes in cortisol and that kind of thing. We've shown that too. But if you just meditate, you bring the thought up. Mm. And if you bring the thought up, but you don't give the person the tools to deconstruct that thought and process through, like you said earlier on, they're going to crash. So right. That's why we need the entire cycle. If you're going to ask a child how they feel, do not do it all the time. Do it for limited periods of time. One block in the day. If you're going to do it at school, one block in the day. If something happens at school, don't spend hours asking these kids how they feel. Yes. It's better to actually, you know, talk about the situation, go through a neurocycle. Okay, let's very quickly. This happened. Okay, so how did that make you feel quick? Where did you feel that in your body? How did you see that? What was your mindset? Okay, why did this happen? Okay, let's write that down. Let's just put all our thoughts on the board or whatever. And okay, what are we going to do about this? This happened. What are we going to do? Okay, what's the action? Let's do it. They're not doing that. They're not going through the cycle. They're pulling it up and these kids are coming. They've got all the stuff that's been activated. They don't know what to do with their energy. So what happens? They don't concentrate at school. They get labeled as ADHD. They get depressed because they're getting teased by their children. They get labeled with depression. They get put on meds that have been shown to be very dangerous for children and adults. And they get put on meds that are multiple diagnoses, multiple meds, and then the child now sees themselves as broken. That's even more dangerous than the med. That's what kills resilience. We come all the way back. You've closed the door, you've locked it, but there is a key and you can unlock it. So there's always hope.
Yeah. So we keep going through that. So help me understand too, because I know there's a lot of confusion. A lot of the parents I work with have this struggle between coddling and building and empathy, right? Supporting. So when I describe empathy, they immediately go, well, that's coddling. We got to toughen them up. This is why kids are so, you know, weak this day or can't handle anything, is that we got to toughen them up. So how do we draw that distinction?
Such a good question. And I know what's happened, because you've swung from the coddle to the, we've swung from pull yourself together to, oh gosh, you know, let's, so there's two extremes. So you can't wallow and you also can't have toxic positivity. Right. You know, so it's to find, and that's what I'm hearing you say, you know, how do we get that balance between, you know, not being too harsh and whatever. It once again comes with you modeling that entire cycle. Yeah. So if something happens, you take it back to yourself and say, okay, if that situation happened to me, this is what I, and something similar, because we can always find something similar, if it's not exactly the same as what your child has experienced. Maybe they were bullied in a specific thing. Maybe at some time you were bullied. Maybe you weren't, but maybe you know of someone who was bullied at some point, at whatever. Find an example and say, okay, this is what happened. Let's go through how it made us feel, whatever, the whole neurocycle. So you sit down and you constructively discuss through. So there's no coddling. There's also no denial, because if we suppress and say, pull yourself together, that's the worst thing you can do as well. It's as bad as coddling, because the coddling is confusing. It brings all kinds of stuff up and doesn't teach them resilience, and it doesn't unlock the resilience and help resilience to grow. And the other side is just plain, well, there's something wrong with me. I can't do this. What's wrong with me? They don't care enough. Or they're a child, an adolescent, and even an adult child will bring it back to what's wrong with me. And when that starts happening, that's going to result in all kinds of behavioral problems. So I talk about in my work, safety net parenting, versus helicopter parenting. Mm. What parents are talking about is they recognize helicopter parenting is not great.
Yeah.
They
recognize there's a lot of us out there.
Exactly. And we've gone through an era where we must helicopter, you know, all the influences, and gosh, there's been such a lot of damage done in that respect, and all the sort of social media psychiatrists and psychologists and whatever that do it. Some do and some don't have qualifications, and a lot of them are talking a lot of scary stuff. Is we've gone through that era of, you know, there's like a shift again from coddle your children to this is not working. So safety net parenting, I believe, is a great way of understanding this. And I was having this debate with a bunch of academics on PBS actually the other day. We were talking about this. And so safety net parenting is, think of a circus. Think of the acrobats. Mm-hmm. Think of the big steps up the side and these different levels. There's like maybe five or six different levels with little ledges where they stand on, and then they swing, and there's, you know, different heights, and they can jump through from one side to the next, and they catch hoops and they catch each other and all those things that they do. And at the bottom, there's a safety net. So safety net parenting is you, the safety net. You've got to let your child climb up the levels. Yes. As they are younger, as they get stronger, as they get older. And you've got to let them jump off the ledge and swing. And maybe they'll get to the other side. Maybe they'll not. And they'll fall. And when they fall, that's when you say, okay, I'm here for you. There's the consequences. Let's now analyze. How did that make you go through the neurocycle? What are we going to do about it? And that's would be my offer, the solution I would offer.
That is so key, because I think, you know, when we talk about the resilience and the feeling broken and what happens when parents are helicoptering and jumping in and saving them and preventing them from failing, we're telling them that you're not good enough to do it on your own. And it's not okay to fail. And so now they're terrified, which is the reverse of resilience. Now I'm just too scared to do anything.
Exactly. And that failure is, you know, failure is the opportunity to learn. Like Edison said when he was asked about the light bulb, what do you think about your 1001 whatever failures? He said, I know there's 1001 things I know don't work. Yeah. And if we could reframe that for the child and see that we have to fail, we have to fall, we have to be sad, we have to be depressed. Depression tells us stuff. Don't try and avoid the depression. Don't try and avoid the anxiety. Face it and find out the information that it contains. That mind shift. There's a great study that came out of University of Tokyo and University of Texas. And it was a few years back. And it was basically showing that when we shift our mindset to see the hard strips of life, the depression, the anxiety, the failures, as something that we can learn from, which is what we feel know. They just confirmed it with scientific study. We actually shift our neurophysiology to be able to function better. And that's what I showed with my research as well. So yeah, we got to shift the perspective.
It is amazing how much of our experience and how much of our own view of ourselves is impacted simply by the stories we're telling ourselves in our head. Absolutely. Like everything becomes our reality. And we become so convinced on that reality that we do everything to protect that reality, and we get stuck with it. And we just need to shift it, which sounds like just is not the word to use. Shifting the mind is not an easy thing to do. No, and I love your steps to do it. That's so useful.
There's steps. There's a guided daily process. And yeah, it's totally.
It's big. So what out of all this, and I could talk to you literally probably for days. There's so many questions I have for you. But what is one big takeaway that you want parents to have after this episode?
I think there's, one is hard.
But I know.
To say, maybe summarize everything, it would be really, you can't change what's happened to you or to your child, but you can, for yourself, change what it looks like inside of you and therefore how it plays out into your future. And you can help your child recognize that and embrace that and change moving out into the future. So let's stop pathologizing childhood and let's stop medicalizing misery, to quote two great psychiatrists in this field, Joanna Moncrief and I think it's Mark Horowitz who said the other one. And let's move forward. Sammy Tamimi is the one who said don't pathologize childhood, because that's what we're doing. You pathologize childhood, you cripple your child, you bubble wrap them, you don't help them, you're not teaching them anything. We've got to. Failure is good. It's a good thing. It teaches us, as you said.
Yeah. I think the biggest hurdle is overcoming our own fear as parents.
We've been made so scared. The whole parenting thing has become something that, and yes, there's been bad parents all through the ages, and we're not talking about the extremes of abusive parenting, but on average, a parent is, if you follow your gut, you know what to do. And sometimes, you know, getting too much advice can be a problem. So I'm always like giving advice and me saying we've got materials and things. Be very selective. If the material that you choose to listen to or watch or use is not equipping you to be empowered and not equipping your child to be empowered to move forward in a very self-regulating manner, and it's making them reliant on a technique, not a technique, on a drug or a label, if it's breaking them, if it's not building them, if it's pathologizing normal adverse life experiences and pathologizing them, then I would steer very clear and far away from it. Yeah. We've got to get balance again.
Yeah, I love that. Dr. Leaf, how can people find you? I know there's a lot of ways.
Well, my social media handles are Dr. Caroline Leaf, and I'm on all the normal platforms. And basically from Instagram, you can get everywhere. My web, drleaf.com is my webpage. And my books are available everywhere, including on our site. The NeuroCycle app is available on Google, iTunes, and we have a web version too. The little book and brainy, that's on our website. These are only available on our website. I have a podcast called Cleaning Up the Mental Mess, where I teach a lot of stuff like you do. And there we go. There's lots of options. And so in the NeuroCycle, there's the NeuroLive webinar, which is like a NeuroCycle club where I cover all kinds of aspects and answer questions. So that's a great extra resource to listen to. It's like a podcast within the app, but it's very specific to these types of specific things of how do I do life.
Oh, I'm listening to that. I love this stuff. Dr. Leaf, thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you for your great questions and for your great work. It's been lovely meeting you.
Lovely meeting you too. And that's a wrap. Thank you, parents, for taking time out of your busy day to listen in. I appreciate you. If you found the episode enlightening, please like, review, and share with a friend navigating the teen years. Until next time, stay curious. Remember, there's always more to the story than what you see.